The newsletter from which we're going to be accessing this information, for those people who did not get a chance to make notes, I will proceed quickly and we will repeat this again. It's called From the Wilderness by a former LAPD narcotics detective named Mike Rupert, with whom we will be visiting before too much longer. It can be reached by mail at 14358 Magnolia Boulevard, Suite 313, Sherman Oaks, California, 91423. That address again, 14358 Magnolia Boulevard, Suite 313, Sherman Oaks, California, 91423. Phone 818-788-8791. That's 818-788-8791. Fax number also in the 818 area code, 981-2847. That's 981-2847. Mike Rupert's website is www.copvcia.com. Once again, www.copvcia.com. Email MRUPPERT@COPVCIA.com. Once again, MRUPPERT@COPVCIA.com. First article we're going to be dealing with from the Wilderness newsletter, and again, it's a newsletter that gets the Dave Emery 5-star rating. I cannot give prices on the air, but it is under $30 a year and well worth it at that price, in my opinion. And again, Mike Rupert is a former LAPD narcotics detective, and while working with LAPD, he came across a number of different overlaps, first of all, between LAPD and the intelligence community, and also between the intelligence community and narcotics trafficking. This first series of allegations that is contained in the From the Wilderness newsletter of June 21st of 1998 concerns the performance of various LAPD personnel vis-a-vis the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. I've covered the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy at considerable length in RFA program number 9, and indeed that program consists largely of material taken from the book The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by John Christian and William Turner. In working with one of the co-authors of that book, John Christian, Mike Rupert has come across the names of a number of his former LAPD colleagues who figure in various ways with regard to the performance of LAPD vis-a-vis the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Let me stress at the beginning of this reading of the article that, as far as I know, none of the people within LAPD has been charged with a crime, nor do I have any concrete evidence of any crime having been committed by any of these individuals. This is not in any way to cast aspersions on the allegations made by Mike Rupert here, but simply in the interests of intellectual and legal honesty, let me stress that point. As far as I know, no criminal charges have been brought against any of these people, nor am I in possession of any evidence indicating any criminal activity on their part. That having been said, let me proceed with this very important article and Mike Rupert's consummately important allegations. Mike Rupert writes again in From the Wilderness of June 21st, 1998, in an article entitled, Bobby, I Didn't Know, RFK, LAPD, CIA, After 30 Years, A Secret Team Exposed. On the evening of June 5th, 1998, the 30th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, I was invited to speak on a panel at the Unitarian Church in Santa Monica. The other members of that panel were Larry Teeter, T-E-E-T-E-R, attorney for Saran Saran, Lynn Mangan, Saran's chief researcher, and Adele Saran, his brother. At that time, I disclosed in public for the first time what I knew about LAPD's role in Bobby Kennedy's assassination and the ugly and well-documented CIA truth behind it. I was only 17 the night Bobby was shot, but as time would prove, I would wind up closer to his killers than I could ever have dreamed. After all I had been through in what was then 15 years of exposing CIA's deep role in the drug trade, I had no knowledge how closely my life was tied in with Bobby's death. It was not until John Christian, co-author of The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy with former FBI agent Bill Turner, sought me out that I began to discover what has been for me the most haunting of truths about my own experience. John found me shortly after People magazine ran a story about me and my years of struggle against the CIA. As the L.A. County press spokesman for the Perot campaign in 1992, I had attracted a lot of attention. I had spoken to Perot before about CIA, and John had been desperately trying to reach him. By the time John found me, the campaign was all but over, and he, like I, soon lost faith in the floppy-eared Texan. But John was, and is, not a quitter. He revealed to me that he had in his possession all 13 volumes of LAPD's RFK investigation, unredacted, and we started talking. He began mentioning names from LAPD, which jarred me because they were people I knew quite well. Some had been involved with CIA's protection of drug dealers and the CIA. In 1993, I went to Montana with John and a retired LAPD sergeant named Paul Shiraga, who had been the first LAPD supervisor to respond to the shooting call at the Ambassador Hotel. Paul was never supposed to be there, and he had paid the price by having his report rewritten, in parentheses forged, to delete information about a second suspect when Bobby was shot. But Paul had kept a carbon copy of his original. Like I, he did not know for many years how CIA had touched his life. It was Christian who had found Shiraga, showed him the rewritten report, and watched as Shiraga grasped that Lieutenant Manny Pena, the officer in charge of Special Unit Senator, had not only committed a crime, but a cover-up which kept getting uglier and uglier. Manny Pena had left LAPD a year or so before the shooting and gone to work for the Agency for International Development, only to, quote, change his mind, unquote, and return just in time to handle the cover-up of Bobby's murder by CIA in conjunction with the LAPD. The simplest way to lay out what I learned by examining the file is to lay out a little chart sequence for you as I describe the people in LAPD who touched me and who were a part of the conspiracy to kill Bobby. The only other thing I need to add is that my mother had been a cryptographer for the NSA, my father had been first an Air Force officer and then a key figure in the development of the Titan 3C, which put up all of the CIA's keyhole spy satellites. My father's cousin Barbara and her husband Sam are both retired from CIA. Sam had been OSS during the Second World War. By the way, one mild criticism I want to voice, and this is not to cast aspersions on what Mike Rupert is saying here, but it has been my experience that very frequently people attribute doings by one element or another of the U.S. intelligence apparatus exclusively to CIA. This is not to say that the people involved here were not CIA, but rather that they may have been working for some other aspect of the intelligence community, and it's also possible that some of them may not have known exactly what it was that they were doing. Frequently, people involved in intelligence operations are dealt with on a need-to-know basis, and they don't need to know what they're not supposed to know, and so sometimes people are involved with things that they had not intended to be involved with in a conspiratorial way. Also, it is a very common error, and I'm not necessarily accusing Mike of this, to attribute to the CIA the machinations of other elements of the intelligence community. Those are frequently CIA, sometimes there are other elements as well. And indeed, the CIA itself has many, many divisions. And again, this is just a slight advisory here, and not in any way to cast aspersions on the very important and, in my opinion, heroic work of Michael K. Rupert, an individual who, in my opinion, embodies the very best that America is all about. Of the personnel that he had come to know while working with LAPD, who also figure in the LAPD's handling of the Robert Kennedy investigation, he begins, Captain R.K. Sillings, S-I-L-L-I-N-G-S. When I started interning for LAPD in October of 1969, I was assigned to Venice Division. The CO was Bob Sillings. On the night of June 5, 1968, Sillings had been the Rampart Division watch commander who, at the last minute, changed key field assignments so that the newly promoted Shiraga could not go out in the field. He had moved key people and chosen to go out into the field himself. But Shiraga, out of cigarettes, had hopped into a black and white to run to a liquor store, which happened to be at the ambassador's back driveway. He was there when the shooting call came out. Sergeant Don Tudor, T-U-D-O-R. Don was a Venice patrol sergeant when I started there. On the night of June 5th, he had been assigned to Metro Division and had assigned key Metro personnel to Central Receiving Hospital. He was in the immediate vicinity when Bobby was shot. Don got me involved in my first personnel complaint against another officer, which resulted in my immediate transfer out of Venice and into Rampart Division. Lieutenant Tackerberry, T-A-C-K-A-B-E-R-R-Y. A Venice Division watch commander had been Lieutenant Tackerberry of Metro Division, on duty and in the field on the night of June 5th. He directed Metro personnel to the ambassador as Rampart Division officers tried to broadcast descriptions of suspects other than Saran. Tackerberry authorized my first ride-alongs as a civilian with LAPD field units. Sergeant David Brath, B-R-A-T-H. One afternoon, as I was working at the Accident Investigation Division out of LAPD's Parker Center, the phone rang, and I was immediately assigned for a special project in Chief Ed Davis's office under the supervision of Brad. Dave wrote me a lengthy commendation which drew me to the attention of Commander Carol Kirby. Dave Braff had been one of the three principal authors of the Special Unit Senator report. By the way, that was the LAPD's report about the Robert Kennedy assassination, and had handled or reported about every key piece of evidence in Ceron's frame-up. Commander Carol Kirby. Shortly after receiving the commendation from Braff, Commander Kirby reported reading a survey response I had written. I was immediately transferred into the inspection and control section of the Office of the Chief of Police. Among other members of Kirby's staff was a senior administrative assistant who had worked in Special Unit Senator. On the night of June 5, 1968, Kirby had been the captain commanding LAPD's Communications Division. He had shown up at the Ambassador Hotel unexpectedly a few minutes after Bobby was shot, and just as a nine-minute, unexplained radio blackout had prevented officers from broadcasting descriptions of the girl in the polka-dot dress and others who had been involved in Kennedy's murder. In 1993, I got to listen to those tapes, and I saw how evidence had been destroyed, timelines altered, and a conspiracy concealed. Sergeant Carl Thompson. It was Carl Thompson who supervised my first loan into Wilshire Division Narcotics as a policeman. Carl had taught me about the Narcotics Intelligence Network, which was, I later found out, how CIA protected their own drug operations. Carl also knew my fiancé, Teddy, who directly exposed me to CIA drug trafficking and tried to recruit me to work for CIA while I was a police officer. Because I was promoting so rapidly, the chances were that I would promote with help into a spot where I could directly assist CIA. When I found out that drugs were involved, I categorically refused, and Teddy left me. Carl Thompson had been a detective in Special Unit Senator, and he had joined LAPD after leaving the highly secret Army Security Agency. He is named in my written testimony for Congress. Detective 3 Lee Goforth, that's G-O-F-O-R-T-H. Teddy had frequently talked of Lee as she talked about CIA operations. Lee was a powerful man in LAPD and the department's assigned rep to the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit, or LEIU. Lee was also a brigadier general in the California National Guard. It was Lee Goforth I was assigned to work with after Teddy left me, and it was Lee Goforth who suggested, along with his partner Norman Bonneau, B-O-N-N-E-A-U, that I was likely having mental problems after I came back from New Orleans and reported that I had seen CIA dealing drugs. On the night of June 5th, 1968, Lee Goforth had been Ethel Kennedy's bodyguard. There were 76 witnesses in the pantry the night Bobby was killed. Not one of them gave a statement which agreed with LAPD's final report. Rosie Greer didn't agree because he never gave a statement to the grand jury. Two LAPD detectives wrote a report which said that they went to his house to get him, and his wife reported he had left town the night before. The detective who wrote the report was Bill Rathburn, R-A-T-H-B-U-R-N, who rose to become a deputy chief in LAPD and later became chief of police in Dallas, Texas. Check out this next connection of Mr. Rathburn's, not necessarily significant, but possibly very significant. Bill Rathburn also handled security for the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta. Of course, there was an as-yet-unexplained bombing at the 1996 Olympics, and the area in which the bomb went off had been visited not too long before, or a few days earlier that week, by Hillary and Chelsea. Next is a description by Mike Rupert of some of the basics of the forensics of the Robert Kennedy assassination, the fact that Coroner Noguchi's report stated that the fatal shot was fired from a distance of approximately 1 to 3 inches behind Robert Kennedy's right ear. The wound was macerated from the force of the muzzle blast. Talks about the security guard, who many people feel was the actual assassin, a white supremacist named Thane Eugene Caesar, who also worked at the Lockheed Burbank facility in an area associated with a top-secret U-2 spy plane of the CIA. And also talks about the very firm indications that Ceron was under mind control and was firing blanks in order to distract attention away from the real shooters. Most people have felt that the real, most analysts to the Kennedy assassination, the Robert Kennedy assassination, have focused on Thane Eugene Caesar as the probable real shooter. Skipping down and reading more, Ceron was hypnoprogrammed using hypnosis, drugs, and torture by, among others, the Reverend Jerry Owen and CIA mind control specialist William Bryan. I would add that William Bryan is dead. Reverend Jerry Owen did win a lawsuit against KCOP and John Christian, the co-author of this book, although the hearing of the case was badly skewered, and the judgment that Jerry Owen received was apparently trivial under the circumstances. I do want to note this for the present purposes. In the book, The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by Turner and Christian, by the way, which describes the suit of Jerry Owen versus KCOP, there was discussion that among the many associates of the Reverend Jerry Owen, who billed himself as the Walking Bible, a right-wing evangelist with more connections than a switchboard, connections running in the direction of organized crime, the political far right, and elements of the intelligence community, one of his religious followers, as described in The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, was a woman named Gail Aiken, who was the brother of Arthur Bremer, the patsy who took the fall for the shooting George Wallace. I say patsy because although Arthur Bremer was seized on the spot and paraffin tests were run on Arthur Bremer, the paraffin tests were negative, indicating he had not fired a gun. Unless he somehow figured a way of spitting the bullets out like Joe Isuzu, that means Arthur Bremer was the patsy. And I would note that when George Wallace was shot, Richard Nixon went from being third, he had been running behind George McGovern and George Wallace, to first in the polls because the racist vote, which had previously been cornered by George Wallace, was then seen as going into Richard Nixon's camp. I mentioned the Gail Aiken-Arthur Bremer Association. Bear in mind they were brother and sister. Gail Aiken, one of the major followers of Reverend Jerry Owen, who was one of Saran Saran's handlers. There's another very fascinating connection between the Bremer family and the milieu of the Robert Kennedy assassination that Mike Rupert touches on. Continuing, and repeating the last couple of sentences, Saran Saran was hypnoprogrammed using hypnosis, drugs, and torture by, among others, the Reverend Jerry Owen and CIA mind control specialist William Bryan. I would add again that I've never seen any evidence linking Jerry Owen to the actual mind controlling of Saran Saran. He was certainly one of Saran's handlers and has dissembled about his role vis-a-vis Saran Saran. There are substantive indications that the late William Bryan was in fact associated with Saran's mind control. That, by the way, discussed in RFA 9, also in RFA 6 about the creation of mind-controlled assassins. Continuing with the From the Wilderness newsletter, they hypnoprogrammed Saran at a stable where he worked months before the shooting. Also working there at the same time was Thomas Bremer, the brother of Arthur Bremer, who in 1972 shot presidential contender George Wallace. And again, Arthur Bremer's brother, Thomas Bremer, was working at the same stable where Saran Saran had been employed. And many people are of the opinion that it was while he was working at this stable that he was put under mind control and pointed towards the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Note again that one of his handlers, whether or not Reverend Jerry Owen was involved with the mind control of Saran, one of his handlers was the Reverend Jerry Owen, one of his chief religious followers, bear in mind he was a right-wing evangelist, was Gail Aiken, who was Arthur Bremer's sister. And Arthur Bremer's brother was employed at the same stable that Saran Saran was working at when he, in all likelihood, was set on his course toward the Ambassador Hotel. A highly unlikely series of coincidences under the circumstances. By the way, once again, let me give you the address, etc., for Spitfire. That's the tape duplication service that stocks the various tapes that I've done over the years. Spitfire can be reached by mail at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. I'm redoing our website after it crashed this past May. That will be up and running before long. You can visit the website at the same website address that you can hear the One Step Beyond show that I do in Northern California if you have the right equipment. That web address is www.kfjc.org. That's www.kfjc.org. Turning once again to the From the Wilderness newsletter put out by Mike Rupert, Mike has a great deal of information about the overlap between elements of the intelligence community and drugs. This is, again, a subject that I've covered at considerable length in the past, and so I'm not going to spend too much program time as I speak in late 1998 about this subject. Again, I have a massive amount of archival material available from Spitfire about the subject. I will, however, fill the listeners in from time to time on aspects of the investigations that I think are important, including some testimony that's come to light as members of the national security establishment who are real Americans, to coin a phrase, not to coin it, but to utilize it. In other words, Americans who don't believe in fascism, drug dealing by the government, and other types of unsavory activities. I've spoken in the past about our national security establishment not being a monolith, and it isn't. I think if there's any hope for this country, it's going to be that people within the, quote, establishment, unquote, in particular the national security and law enforcement establishments, who are willing to take a stand against these types of activities, do so. And in fact, some have. I think Mike Rupert exemplifies the type of American hero that this country is going to need if it's going to pull through. And so, too, there have been people involved with the military and the intelligence community who have witnessed the involvement of elements. Again, note the use of the term elements of the intelligence community in the drug trade, and have taken a stand against this. An individual who was deeply involved with helping to set up some of the drug traffic associated with elements of the Central Intelligence Agency was a former Army Special Forces veteran named Bill Tyree. His last name is capital T-Y-R-E-E. And he is discussed in the From the Wilderness newsletter of April 25th of 1998. This is an article headlined, Special Forces Vet Bill Tyree Making Legal Moves to Upset 1979 Murder Conviction Based on CIA Ops. It reads, For 19 years, Bill Tyree, a U.S. Army Special Forces veteran and political prisoner, has sat in Massachusetts Walpole Prison, wrongly convicted of the murder of his own wife. To many in the struggle to expose CIA involvement in drug trafficking, he has become an icon of injustice and his freedom a personal goal. His story is the subject of an upcoming segment of Investigative Reports with Bill Curtis, scheduled to air on A&E on June 13, 1998 at 9 p.m. Eastern. Bear in mind, this is the April 25th, 1998 installment of From the Wilderness, or issue of From the Wilderness, and I'm speaking now in early September of 1998. Continuing, in another recent surprise, Senator Ted Kennedy has written to federal officials asking for a review of Tyree's case on grounds that his rights were violated in his trial 19 years ago. In the mid-1970s, Bill Tyree and other U.S. Army Special Forces troops under the command of Colonels Ed Q. Tolo, Bo Baker, and others were ordered to enter Colombia and plant radio transponders so that CIA flights laden with cocaine could fly below radar into Albrook Field in Panama, where they were met by the likes of Manuel Noriega and Ed Wilson. These operations, known as the Watchtower missions, evolved over time into a more draconian program known as Operation Orwell, which was conducted in part from Fort Devens, Massachusetts. Devens was the home of the 10th Special Forces Group, commanded by Q. Tolo. The purpose of Orwell was to conduct massive domestic surveillance on political figures and police to keep knowledge of the drug operations secret. These activities have been described in an affidavit known as the Q. Tolo Affidavit, which has been widely circulated among opponents of CIA drug trafficking. Although not written by Q. Tolo, the affidavit has withstood numerous vettings and is now supported by hundreds of pages of additional affidavits, court documents, and written statements. From the Wilderness is in possession of those documents and is making preparations to make them available to readers. One of those documents is an admission from CIA that the Watchtower missions occurred and that CIA has Watchtower documents that they are refusing to release. After becoming disheartened in 1978, Bill Tyree became a security risk. His wife, Elaine, who was keeping a diary, was murdered. Bill Tyree was framed for that murder, even though there were witnesses who saw the real killers emerge from his bedroom, and there were other witnesses who gave Tyree a perfect alibi. Tyree's arrest was initially thrown out by a local judge, but a young district attorney, John Kerry, picked up the case and refiled it. In an unusual move, the Massachusetts State Supreme Judicial Court took the case and would let no other court hear it. Tyree was convicted shortly thereafter. At the time of his arrest, a number of personal items with evidentiary value, such as notebooks, uniforms, and other personal effects, were taken, and they have not surfaced since. They are still in the custody of Massachusetts authorities. They would help Tyree establish his innocence. In spite of numerous requests and a legal responsibility to do so, the courts and prosecutors have never given Tyree back his belongings. On April 29th, Tyree will have a court hearing asking for the presence of Kerry, now the junior senator from Massachusetts, and the current district attorney, to answer to charges of receiving stolen property. Kerry, as many of you know, chaired the oft-quoted Senate hearings in 1986 and 7, which documented much of CIA's role in the Iran-Contra-era drug trade. His role in Tyree's case remains a mystery to many of us. Tyree's attorney, Ray Coleman, a law partner of William Pepper, who is representing the late James Earl Ray, is optimistic that one day Tyree will walk out a free man. I agree, if Bill can remain intact long enough. Recent optimism has been dampened by several recent food poisonings of Tyree, which have been followed by punishments for his inability to report to work. There are also rumors that Tyree may soon be transferred to another prison, where one of the soldiers involved in killing his wife is serving time on another conviction. And we're going to continue with the story of Bill Tyree a little later on, if not in this broadcast, then in a future program. Again, Mike Rupert, the former LAPD narcotics detective who puts out From the Wilderness, can be contacted by mail. By the way, From the Wilderness is available for by subscription for less than $30 a year. I cannot give the price. It gets the Dave Emery five-star rating. The address, 14358 Magnolia Boulevard. That's 14358 Magnolia Boulevard, Suite 313, Sherman Oaks, California, 91423. Phone and fax, both in the 818 area code. Phone, 788-8791. Fax, 981-2847. His website is www.copvcia.com. That's www.copvcia.com. Email, mrupert, M-R-U-P-P-E-R-T, at copvcia.com. And again, the particulars for Spitfire, which has Radio Free America number 9 about the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the other archive shows about the intelligence community and drugs, and the various half-hour segments I've done. Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email address, spitfire@ix.netcom.com. In the next half-hour segment, we're going to once again access information from the Wilderness newsletter of Mike Rupert. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.